Trinity. Halloween Podcast. Very special Halloween edition.
Hey guys, it's Kenneth Allen. How are you? Welcome back to another exciting episode of Traumedy Podcast. It's the Halloween edition. Are you ready for it? Are your hackles on your backles standing up? Oh, golly, golly. I hope he doesn't come to my door. He's knocking. That's those hard fingers. They're claws. Oh, man. Sorry. All right. I got to tell you, I love Halloween. It's the one time a year where you can really feel the change from life and death. Ooh, is that the reason why? Yeah, it is kinda. It's this creepy little time in life where you feel the change. You feel life slow down and die off. You go and cut all the rest of the fruit from the vine, and you store it and jar it and can it and save it, and you start to go into social and physical hibernation. But just as you do, you almost feel the spirits. You know, they're almost visible. You can almost hear them. It's like, was that it? No, it was just the rustling of the leaves. What's burning? You know, you smell it in the air, but it's a little bit creepy. It's a little bit dreamlike this time of year. And it's weird because it's hot. It seems overly hot. And then it seems overly cold. It's just this weird change. And when that comes, it's like the witching hour, you know. It's that real nexus between life and whatever life is not. I don't know if it's an opening to the other world, but some people seem to feel that way. Most people don't believe in ghosts and the afterlife and hell, but this time of year, it's almost like you keep looking for it out of the corner of your eye because you're just not sure. You don't want to be caught off guard if it taps you on the shoulder one cold autumn evening as you're walking through the park alone. Remember, you can find us on traumedypodcast.com, Stitcher Radio, and iTunes. Tonight we're going to do something different than an interview. This is an audiobook / radio show. And I hope you enjoy it. I had a lot of fun putting this thing together, and hopefully it gets your hackles up. Remember, there might be an afterlife, but this is the one that really counts. This story's called The Hearing. My name is Charles M. Witt, and this is my confession. I did nothing wrong. What I did for the greater good. It may be difficult for you to see this at face value, but listen. See. See with your real eye, the unflinching one. You'll come to understand. And once you do see, it's impossible to unsee. And you come to know that what I did was not vengeance or a schizoid break, but an act of mercy and compassion.
my heart was in the right place, and my mind was always on the greater good. There are these people that we as lifesavers, medics, EMTs, firefighters, nurses, go on all the time. We call them frequent flyers. They're chronic, terminal skid row wretches with medical problems that never get cured, but rather only deteriorate a little bit more each time I see them. They're on a gradual autopiloted tailspin into the fucking mountain. A lot of them are homeless or in halfway houses or some kind of minimum security housing, like Donald was. They're in and out of prison, most of them alcoholics or drug addicts or both, or left of sanity down one crazy tangent or another. People with two or three heart attacks under their belt and in heart failure still, their body and lungs and fluid overload, so they bloat up like sausages, or incrementally drowned on their own plasma. They got diabetes that they can't keep in check, and we find them either raving in some kind of hyperglycemic crisis, they have that smell of old meat and acetone on their breath, or they're near comatose, cold and slimy skin like dead fish in insulin shock. They're hot messes, cold soup sandwiches. They never get it in check. They never even try to climb out from underneath the rock they're living in. They're on government penance just enough to buy fast food and chemical crutches. They can't or won't get sober. See, they won't work because then they don't qualify for welfare. Do you see the cycle? Do you see these people are prisoners in or out of the penitentiary? They must know. In some corner of their minds, they see it in the eye on top of their heads that they're still a prisoner. They're prisoners of the world. So they waste away in their holes, drinking and shitting and falling apart. What can be done for them? We sweep them up, clean them off, feed them, clothe them, send them to rehab centers, refer them to clinics, hold their hands through the procedures, and at the end ask them, is there anything else we can do? But still, they lie about and wasting away in the dregs of the day. I've thought so many times to make one of them my passion project. I could bring them to meetings and ask them about their life, find out what went wrong, tea and sympathy, the whole bit. But if I did that with one, then I'd have to do it for the next one, and the next one, and the next one. And when does it end? When do I say enough is enough? I need my energy for my life. Why aren't you using your energy for your life? Why aren't they asking me what they can do for me? Do you understand? You understand. I cared for so long. But eventually it's just too much. It's too much. It's too much. It's akin to picking out all the black grains of sand on all the oceans on the earth. It makes me want to start my old habit of tapping each finger of each hand 16 times on the table. Back and forth, back and forth, back and forth until that's the problem. Until when? When do I stop? How do I stop? I finally got all my worms back in the can I opened, and I'm not opening it again. Not for them. Not for anyone. The time now is to act, to cut, to cull. And so with this in mind, let's talk about Donald Kent. This guy's a tomato bisque hoagie. He's an alcoholic, diabetic. He's had four MIs, four heart attacks. He's got congestive heart failure, atrial fib. He's in full renal failure. He goes to dialysis 3 days a week. And of course, he's got hypertension and high cholesterol. If you're going to have everything else, why not throw those in for good measure? He's not the kind of guy that skimps. And we went on him all the time. At least once a tour. And that's just my ambulance. Not to speak of how many other times medics had gone when I'm in another part of the city. Or when I'm off. When I'm off of work, I mean. Sometimes it's for shortness of breath from the pulmonary edema. He's choking on his own juices. I can still smell cigarettes on his breath. The guy's drowning and smoking at the same time. sometimes for chest pain or dizziness or syncopes. Mostly, it's for diabetic reasons. He takes his insulin and then doesn't eat. He had a Filipino caretaker 3 times a week, and his mother would come by on the off days. Can you believe that? He's 52 years old. His mother still comes by to check on him. She's got atrial fib and hypertension, too. Still, she's taking care of her kid. And still, he couldn't remember to fix himself a square meal. Some of you think it sounds pathetic. I know. It's okay. I'm not going to judge you. I won't judge him. I won't judge you. I'm beyond that now. I think he's just another pig in a pen. He's only got one direction to go, and it's forward, towards the abattoir. That apartment, Jesus. Side note. When people find out you're a paramedic or fireman, or EMT or nurse, without fail, they'll eventually ask you, "What's the worst thing you've ever seen on the job?" And they look at you with these wide eyes, excited, and they're hoping to hear some harrowing adventure. Something to make the dinner party conversation great. People, please don't ask this. You really think I want to remember the most gruesome, horrible day of my life for your benefit? That's like me saying to you, "Tell me about you and your husband's divorce. How did he tell you he was fucking another woman? Or what was it like when you had to put your dog down?" All that's to say, it's impolite and unappreciated. But nevertheless, I know the question will always come, and you can't help it. You don't understand what you're asking. It's okay. I don't hold it against you. I'm beyond judging now. So I always have this chambered retort. I always say, "It's not the worst thing I've ever seen. It's the worst thing I've ever smelled." And though there are those calls, the gangrenous arms and legs, or the melena, which is blood that's partially digested inside someone's feces, or the runny, liquefying, two-day-old corpses that we get to call for the welfare check, those take the coffee cake. But there is something to say about the state of affairs in those dilapidated gutter rooms, like the one Donald lived in, where nary a vacuum cleaner has swept literally for decades, if ever at all. The old food's moldering on the table, or in between the crusty couch cushions, and the dirty clothes reek in sour heaps in the corner of the room. Flies live out their entire lives in these rooms. They're born in the food. They die on the window ledge, probably trying to escape that stink. Donald's house smelled like that. Oily, sour, dead and still rotting. And you know the dust motes floating in the air are really his dead skin cells and dandruff flakes. So we'd go in there, shift after shift, stick a line in him, all the while smelling his stink and getting his slick yellow sweat all over our clothes, inhaling his dead tissue, pump him full of dextrose and cart him off to the hospital. They'd keep him for a few hours and then send him home. I've gone on this guy twice in the same shift. It doesn't get infuriating. I don't get infuriated. I don't get sad. Not anymore. It gets so one knows that something must be done about it. It begs for action, not emotions. And each time we'd say to him, "Donald, you have to eat. Why do you keep doing this? Why? Do you know what you're doing to yourself?" And he'd always just look at us and say, I know. "Sorry, guys." And he'd have this guilty, juvenile, sheepish grin on his face. And I really started to not appreciate it. I did not appreciate that look. I didn't get angry. I just started to not appreciate it very much. He's smiling and looking at us like an incorrigible boy. We're doing the medical equivalent of spoon-feeding him. Some people would be infuriated. Not me, but some people. It'd get so I'd hear the dispatch for the complex, and the sinking feeling would come over me. It would darken me somehow. I'd be staring at the speaker from that place on the top of my head, you know. And I'd hear his words, "Sorry, guys, but I did it again." That sheepish grin. And then I started hearing it like it was a sitcom, and that was his catchphrase. "Sorry, guys, but I did it again.
And then I'd hear the canned laughter in the background. But then I'd start thinking about him when I was off of work. I'd be walking to the store for a bottle, and I'd think I'd hear the chimes of the dispatch. And I'd be staring at the sidewalk, but really I'm looking at the top of my head again. And the speaker's in my mind, and I'm hearing the digits. Cumberland Hill Apartments, room 409. I'd roll over in bed at 2 in the morning, and I'd hear, "Sorry, guys, I did it again." And I'd hear the canned laughter track. And he'd go again, and I'd hear it again and again. It was August 5th. I know because it was exactly a week from the day that I read Dante's Inferno, and that was August 12th through the 13th. I couldn't put it down once I started, so I kept looking at... All right, I'm getting sidetracked, but... I was cleaning the wheels of the ambulance, because I keep my ambulance clean. I wipe it down twice in the morning, once I get the old shift's residue out, and the second, I prepare it sparkling. I like to think of it that way. It's prepared sparkling, ready for my shift. Anyway, I heard the tones go out in the dispatcher. Medic 36, respond code 3 to Cumberland Hill Consortium Apartments, 128 Keating Drive, room 409, for the 52-year-old male diabetic problems. And then the eye in my head opened up, and this time I fixed it on the speaker and held it. And I knew what I was going to do. We walk in. Filipino caretaker standing at the door opening it up for us. He's got the phone cradled in his right shoulder, and he's still talking to dispatch. And the other hand's pointing towards the room to the right. The family room. The famine room. The fucking wasting room. The room with that pea-green striped couch. It's loaded with layers of skin cells and spilt beer and piss. Come, most likely. I'm sorry to be vulgar, but once you know a thing, it's undeniable. I can picture armies of microscopic mites living inside those couch cushions, hungrily chomping away at his body part pieces. Smell the turpentine and McDonald's French fries, and the unwashed hair. You know that smell of dirty, sweaty feet? It's like sharp vinegar cheese hanging in the air. It's so thick you can cut it with a cheese knife. Anyway, he's out like a light. He's foaming at the mouth, even. I started a big line. I got a 16-gauge in him. Most of his veins at this point are scarred over. They're sunken because we keep giving him IVs and pumping sugar through him. But I nail it. Catheter slips in like a knife into a scabbard. Shoom. Buried it to the hub. Connected it to saline. Ran it. Chip chambers, not even dripping. It's got this clear, clean stream of saline down the line. I had this image now in my head of his brain and billions of tiny brain cells. I can see it. It's as far as the eye can see, the eye on my head. And I see on these neurons, these tiny, teeny, tiny mouths. And all the mouths are sucking and puckering.
Feed us. We won't feed ourselves. We won't take care of ourselves, but you need to. You have to feed us.
And I see this nest of bird chicks, and their beaks are open wide, and their mother's over them, and she's regurgitating half-eaten food into their mouths. And I see that his mouth now is hanging slack-jawed, half-open, just like the images I see of the birds and the mouths on the neurons. And it makes me gag. But I didn't get sick. I wasn't disgusted. I wasn't angry. I'm beyond that, as I said. I had finally started acting in accordance of the greater good. If not for Donald's sake, who, if he actually would fess up to it, was on a roundabout, shambling suicide run, then for the greater good. Who else can do what I did? Who else sees this part of life? I didn't see him as a spoiled man-child. Someone who needs everyone around him to stuff food down his gullet and then wipe his ass for him when it comes out. If he needed to be taken care of, then I would take care of him. I was going to do my duty. I gave him the dextrose. I pushed it so easily through the 16-gauge
The dextrose we call liquid Snickers because it's basically Snickers. It's a simple syrup. And sometimes if you're pushing it through a smaller IV, like a 20 gauge, it takes a long time. There's a lot of resistance. But with this one, it flowed right through, breathlessly easy. Before he could begin to wake up, I and Mac had already loaded him onto the gurney and were wheeling him out to the ambulance. I couldn't do what I was going to do on the scene there, not with the caretaker and the engine company there, so we had to go to the ambulance first to do it. Anyway, we left there, caretaker's holding the door for us, and he's saying he'd meet us at the hospital, and we're waving and smiling back at him. Okay, take your time, no need to rush. He's going to be just fine. But I hadn't left empty-handed. I had taken 4 vials of Donald's insulin. I should explain now how insulin works before we go any further. Insulin is needed to bind onto and carry sugar from the bloodstream into the cells. That's why diabetics who can't make insulin need to inject themselves with it. Otherwise, all the sugar from the food they're eating just pumps around and around and around in the bloodstream, but never gets into the cells. Eventually, all that unused sugar just gets pissed out in the urine. In a lot of ways, it's like Donald's life. That had so much potential, but never gets used. And eventually, well, just he pisses it away. It reminds me of that poem by Thomas Gray that goes, "Full many a flower is born to blush unseen and waste its sweetness on the desert air." Well, that's nice. That should have been Donald's eulogy. So, diabetics have to inject themselves with insulin in order to use the sugar that they're eating. But you have to be careful how you inject it. The insulin has to be absorbed slowly by the body, over hours. Most people inject it into the fatty tissue in their abdomen. It takes about 4 or 5 hours to trickle into the bloodstream. Otherwise, you have alternate effects that can occur if the insulin is injected, say, intravenously. One thing that happens is the sugar gets absorbed very rapidly by the body and not by the cells that need it the most, mainly the brain. But two, and this is what I was banking on, when the insulin takes sugar into the cells, somebody else comes along for the ride. Potassium. The insulin brings in potassium with it. And because potassium is a positively charged ion, it makes the cell positively charged too. Extremely positively charged. And when that happens, those cells don't conduct electricity so well. I'm not going to get into the science of everything. But what that means is, once the signal gets there, it stops. It's usually okay for other cells, but there's one cell in particular, it's not so great. That's the cardiac cell. If you charge a cardiac cell and make it extremely positive, then it can't beat. And if the cell can't beat, then the tissue can't beat. And if the tissue can't beat, then the heart doesn't beat. The term for it is cardiac standstill, and it's the principle behind lethal injection. And where they use potassium chloride, I was going to use insulin. It's very clean, it's painless, and above all, it's very humane. So I walked from that apartment with 4 vials of insulin, lined up in a row in my jacket pocket. I remember feeling them with my free hand, rolling them like a leapfrog as we wheeled Donald to the ambulance. 1, 2, 3, 4. And the vials jumped from the back of the line to the front. 1, 2, 3, 4. Mac locked me down inside alone in the ambulance with Donald. It was never Don, I realized. And the captain double-slapped the back of the rig, and Mac pulled off into traffic. We're going code 2, St. Christopher. Donald's stirring now, and I took out the 4 vials and popped off their tops. And they had this weight to them.
that I remember marveling over. They weren't heavy, but I could feel their gravity. I drew up all the four vials into a 20cc syringe and flipped it upside down, and I flicked it lightly to get all the air out. Why bother with that, I remember thinking. But I'm working from a discipline, and like all things one does in life, they should be carried out with precision and purpose, correctness. He was coming around now, and the sweat stood out on his face. I remember it was all dirty, and his hair was matted. And then he turned to me, and I saw his eyes. And he had that sheepish child's guilty grin over his face again. I could feel it crawling inside my head, and the anticipation of those words made my heart speed up. Looks like I did it again, huh? And then I turned to him, and I said, "That's right, Donald. But the good news is, you're never going to do it again." And I screwed the syringe onto the port. "This syringe is insulin," I said. "And now," and I pushed the plunger down, "you'll never, ever have to worry about anything ever again. It's going to kill you instantly. And you're going to finally be at peace." I started to say that anyway, but Jesus, that kid smirk fell off his face and his jaw dropped and then clinched. And then he was clawing at me like a cat. He's tearing at the seat belts and he's trying to pull the restraints off, reaching for my arms. He grabbed at the IV tubing and he made to tear it out. A lot of good it would have done. I already pushed the insulin inside his veins. It's coursing through. But then he grabbed for it anyway. So I just clasped around his forearm and held his hand right on the IV and locked down so he couldn't pull it out. I wasn't pleased. I wasn't exalted, and what of the smile on my face? I was satisfied that I was doing something right, finally doing what needed to be done. No one else would do it, including him. He starts screaming, and then Max shouted from the front, "Is everything all right?" And I said, "Fine." And Donald's screaming, "Help! Help!" at the top of his lungs, and Max did slow down for a little bit, and he started to pull over. I told him it was cool, keep driving. One thing about all that struggling that was good, he started burning off all the sugar that's in his system real quick, and then within about a minute, he starts losing strength. And after about another 30 seconds, I can see his eyes are starting to stare off and they're getting less focused. Didn't take long until he started loosening up completely and then passed out again. Well, not really passed out. Passed on, I guess. The shouting match thing was going to be hard to explain to the hospital and Mac, but maybe not. What was there to explain? Shit. He probably felt the heart attack coming, Doc. And he started screaming for me to help him. And he just crashed. I did everything I could, but it was no good. He was just too weak for it. Except he wasn't too weak. I watched the monitor, seeing his heart rate slow first, and saw those big wide waves we call tombstones start popping up on the EKG. They mean exactly what you think they mean. It's bad news for the heart. A minute went by, then another, then two, then four passed, and still his heart wouldn't stop. It was like those old radio DJs would say, "The beats just keep coming." Mac asked from the front, "What happened?" I told him, "He just went unconscious again. Hang on." And then I was putting the defibrillator pads on him. If he wouldn't go quietly into that good night, then I could help him along with a swift kick in the ass, by God. See, you shock people with a defibrillator to get the electricity in the heart back into an organized rhythm. But if you shock a healthy heart, you can knock it out of whack just as easy. And that's what I believe would happen. I had to act fast here. Can you imagine Donald waking up in the hospital after they stabilized him and he's telling them what I said to him? They'd probably not believe him, but I guess I knew about that other thing then, but at the time my mind wouldn't register it. My eye on the top of my head, my mind's eye, was locked on the job at hand. I had to finish here. I had to end him. I had to complete this.
Had to send him off.
I had to set him free.
So I charged up the defibrillator. Mac heard it and said, Jesus, what's he dead? And he made to pull off and then realized it wouldn't do any good pulling over. We had to get to the hospital anyway, and he started changing lanes over to the far left so we could upgrade the lights and sirens. The defibrillator was at full charge. Deliver shock now. And I hit him with it. Bam! He bounced up, then laid limp. The screen went blank. The waves fell down, flatline, asystole. Nothing. Finally. And just as I was thinking, thank God, I hear, beep, beep, beep. It started back up.
You got him?
Max says. I don't know, I said. And I was lowering down the volume on the monitor so he wouldn't hear it anymore. Now, Donald's heart actually starts speeding up. He's getting better. What the fuck, right? So I charge it up again. Shock him again. Bam! Back to flatline. Nothing. Then 10 seconds later, beep, beep, beep. Holy fucking God, right? I charge it up again. Slam him again. Bam! Flatline. Beep, beep, beep. Again. Shock. Bam! Beep, beep, beep. It's not stopping. It will not stop. Then I hear Max shouting in the front. We're pulling up into the hospital, but I can barely hear him over the shouts. And then I realize that it's me who's shouting. And I became aware of what I was shouting over and over again. Why won't you die? Why won't you die? Why won't you die? I don't remember everything exactly how it came next, but I remember the ambulance lurching to a stop. I remember the doors flinging open and Mac first unlocking the gurney and then jumping in and pulling me out, throwing me on the ground, and me trying to get up, and the hospital orderly that had come out to help unload the patient first helped me up, and then after taking my hand, he's holding me back and Max shouting something at him. Then he holds onto my hand and won't let go. He must have thought I was trying to fight to get this guy back, that I was over emotional about it and I was trying to save him. Well, I mean, I was in a way. I did really care. Mac wheeled him with another medic that was standing outside into the hospital, and he looked up at the orderly and he said, keep him here, don't let him in. And I just stood there panting, sweating, thinking, what comes next? What did I just do? What comes next? What came next is really hazy. Whether it's because I was doped up or intentionally trying to escape it, doesn't matter. The news reporters, the 10 o'clock report, followed by the morning exclusive report, all the news reporters everywhere outside, pushing through them, getting me into the car to move me to the next jail. Standing in line and booking, a lot of sitting in cells for hours and thinking. Then a few minutes of harried escort transfers, people sitting in elevated seats behind plexiglass, telling you to sign this, stamp this, push on this, fucking walk this way. And then you're back in another cell, and you're sitting and thinking. But I didn't have anything to think about. I knew what I had done was for the greater good. It was for society. Hell, it was even for Donald, really. It was. One thing I did not appreciate was how everybody stares at you when you're in there. They have these big, wondering, cautious lemur glares. Not really judging, but absorbing you. Like they're trying to figure out how to ingest you. They're inhaling my life energy like I used to inhale Donald's cells. At the court case, I kept hearing the snippet from a Dylan song in my head over and over again. The trial was a pig circus. He ain't never had a chance. It kept going over in my head, over and over. I kept my head down, but the eye on top of my head saw everything. Saw everyone's eyes. Donald's account of the conversation in the back of the rig
Mac's testimony, which corroborated Donald's story, were the nails in my coffin. But the hammer that drove it down into the pine box was the audio tape. You see, I had all but forgotten that all the new defibrillators we have are equipped with audio recording. When the monitor's turned on, it automatically begins recording all ambient sound, and obviously dialogue. It had everything there. From our first little palaver, me saying I was going to kill him, to my shouts, well, I didn't say that, me telling him he was going to die, to my shouts screaming, why won't you die? Why won't you die? Blah, blah, blah. Jesus. That was the beginning, middle, and end of the case, of the hearing. I just kept waiting for that word, guilty, to come, but it took forever. But when it finally registered, I realized I was sitting in my new room and wearing the gray clothes that almost look like OR scrubs, but you know they're not. So guess where I am now? Of course, I'm at Cumberland Hill, the criminally insane wing. And I know Donald's down there somewhere. I know he's down there. They said on the news that they had been through hell and he had survived. The news reporters said that they had gotten together and thrown a benefit for Donald. They had scrounged up enough money to get him out of Cumberland Hill and into a little place of his own. You know who they are? The people I was trying to do right by. Doing the greater good for. They said Donald's doing great. He's gotten a hold on his medical problems and his addictions, and he's staying out of jail and is re-entering society and trying to put the tragic events to rest, unquote. That's what they said anyway. But I know they're lying. I know he's down there on the fourth floor still. Down in room 409. I know, because I can still hear his heart beating. It won't stop. It won't fucking stop. That was an interesting experiment. I hope you enjoyed it. I had a hell of a good time doing it. Oh, this is going to be a two-parter, just so you know. So tune in for another interesting story and weird tale soon to come. Until next time, I'm Kenneth Allen. This is the Traumedy Podcast. Remember, we're on Stitcher, iTunes, and your computer and iPhone anytime you want. If you got it, use it. And happy Halloween, everyone.